Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, in American Variety, we've explored lots of different topics in science and technology and engineering over the years. Often they're mainstream topics and sometimes not. My guest today is the curator of the largest collection of animal excrement in the world, so I guess we could consider that to be non-mainstream. He's a paleontologist who's the chair of East Tennessee State University's Department of Geosciences. His name is Dr. Jim Mead. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Court.
This topic of your collection of animal dung has excited some interest among closet coprophiles. I think that may be a word. Everybody go to the dictionary. Look that up. Dictionary.com.
Definitely.
Anyway, but I saw it while sitting in a doctor's office not too long ago in the April 2010 issue of Popular Science. They had a special on 10 worst jobs in science, and there you were. I'm sure you were delighted to find that, in their estimation, you had one of the 10 worst jobs in science. But I'm equally sure you don't agree. So anyway.
It was actually pretty hilarious, but I thought, oh, this is cool, and it is a blast of a job. So I totally accept that pun of one of the 10 worst jobs.
Well, another thing, too, then, when I looked you up, I saw that in May of 2010, you were featured on the Rachel Maddow Show's Geek Week. Now, who would have thought that Rachel Maddow would have, you know, somebody who, she sent a correspondent to interview Dr. Mead in his lab where, you know, you were displaying samples of your caca collection, shall we call it, or whatever. And so you can see it's impossible to deal with this subject without at least initially making a couple of jokes about it, but we'll try to get serious from here on.
And you have to. It is humorous. So, and you can also use a different word every time you say it.
Pretty much.
It's all fun.
Yeah, I made a whole list, and I won't go through it all. But, you know, you did impress me with your good-natured approach. You're a real sport, right, to all this juvenile teasing that was going on during this interview. And you obviously take all that in stride and still try to convey, you know, some idea of the interest and the value that comes out of this kind of research. So I mentioned at the outset, Jim, that your research interests are in paleontology, which is the study of what ancient life forms through their fossils. And
correct.
So the breadth of your research profile is much broader than just what we could call scatology here, I guess. But let's do focus on that for a while, since it's interesting and there actually is a lot of serious scientific knowledge to be gained from the study of ancient and modern excrement. So how big is your dung collection?
Well, the actual specimens we have, which are mostly modern but some fossil, is about 900. I forget exactly how many we have when I moved here 2 years ago from another job. So about 900 of the 13,000 specimens we've moved out are specifically dung.
Are they all vertebrates?
Yes, yeah, they're all vertebrates, but they go from, you know, birds through, you know, crocodiles, koalas, you know, the whole gamut, if you will. We got lizards, we got a variety of things. Anything that, I mean, it's not a collection like you'd have of coins. Oh, I've got to have one of everything.
Yeah.
What it is to have things that we could find in the fossil record. So if I go into a dry cave and I find, you know, bones of this, and maybe there's some archaeological layer higher up or whatever that has some stuff, that's wonderful. But also we come across this dung. Well, I want to know what it is, because maybe there's a hidden secret in that.
Mm.
Maybe it's an animal. I mean, we can all go out to our lawn and go, okay, I see that pile of stuff. Some dog has been by here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the dog. I just know a dog was here. Well, it's that same sort of thing, but let's put it back 10,000, 20,000 years
sure. In
a dry cave where it was preserved. So I need a little bit of almost everything.
Well, you said you have a collection that's a mixture of fossils and modern specimens, but are all of the ancient specimens necessarily fossils, or do you sometimes find, like, you know, recently there was a baby mammoth was found on the shore of a river in, I guess it was a thawing tundra in Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
So an animal like
right.
that, I would suspect, had some fecal contents in its intestines, right? Do you get some of that?
You bet. Oh, yeah. No, I don't have any of that one. But years ago, a colleague and I worked with some Japanese researchers and Russian researchers, back then Soviet Union, and we worked on another baby mammoth, and we were looking at the stomach contents and the intestinal tract contents, which is really just dung at that point.
Sure.
And, of course, we knew what it came from because it was inside that little guy. And so it was easy to, quote, identify. But, yeah, when we say fossil, I don't mean that it's necessarily fossilized. I'm just saying it's old. It's older than grandma. It has some ancient quality to it. But if you picked it up, you'd go, wait a minute, this looks and smells like it's from a barnyard today. How old is it?
Oh, is that right? So a 10,000-year-old specimen of poop will still smell like dung?
Oh, yeah.
You're kidding.
Now, you go into a cave, like, say, one of the caves in the Grand Canyon. You go in there and you kind of go, this room smells like an old, dried barnyard. And then you look around, you see this stuff, and you kind of go, I hope whatever made that is not going to come back through the front door while I'm in here, because that's going to be scary.
Yeah.
Then if you rehydrate it, so you take it back in the lab and you're very proud, you open up the bag and pull out this ancient-looking dung, you rehydrate it to break it apart to look for, say, pollen and various fragments in there, and all of a sudden you get 10,000-year-old smell.
I'll be darned.
It rehydrates all the bile acids and everything else, and voila, you're taken right back in time.
So it sounds like one of your most prolific types of search venues is deserts and very dry areas. Obviously, that wouldn't hold up too well in a jungle over 10,000 years. But is that the case? I mean, and the other thing is, how do you get the majority of your specimens? Do you personally and your grad students and your immediate colleagues at the university go out and collect them personally, or do people send them to you from around the world, or how does that work?
Well, when I first began, I was a graduate student at University of Arizona, and my mentor and very good colleague friend, Paul Martin, was out collecting stuff all the time, whether it was getting a cow that was, you know, loose in the environment on the Colorado Plateau, or if it was a rhino out in Serengeti. He would collect that stuff and bring it back, and we would dry it out. Well, nowadays, you can't just go over to Tanzania, collect stuff, and bring it back in without both governments saying, what are you doing with this stuff?
That's right. I was picturing the security line with a bag of this stuff, but anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, Paul Martin had that coming back. He was coming in, I think, through Florida back in, I don't know, late 50s, early 60s, and they said, what do you have in that suitcase? And he said, it's full of rhino shit. And they said, all right, open up your suitcase. And it was. It was total rhino poop in that thing.
Mm.
So they kind of just said, go away.
Get out of here.
Nowadays, they'd say, we have to confiscate that.
Yeah.
So I don't really collect that much, you know, internationally really anymore because of that, although I can get permits for it. It's a true hazard. You got to watch out what bugs you're bringing with you. So
sure.
I really, you know, don't do that. Now, if I can totally dry it out, freeze it, do things like that elsewhere, then I can get a permit to bring it back in. But we would only want to do this totally legal. But basically, a lot of the collection, I've just gone out and collected. You know, you can also do it at zoos.
Mm.
So I've gone to many zoos and said, I'd like to look at the south end of all your northbound animals and make a collection. And that way I know that came from that animal.
All right, so picturing your lab, which, by the way, is called the Neogene Vertebrate Paleontology Laboratory, a very very formal-sounding name. It sounds like a pristine, clean, clinical place, but I'll bet it's not entirely. How do you organize the specimens, and how do you preserve them? I mean, you're talking about wet material that does stink. I guess there's an aroma in your lab, right? So,
well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, I won't keep things wet. So if I go to a zoo and say, oh, boy, look at that rhino, I will dry it out thoroughly, and when I bring it back to the lab, I'll dry it out again to make sure I don't have typical bugs in it. And then I'll keep it in a box in an environment that's dry. Now, when I was in Arizona, you know, their dryness and humidity is quite different than here in Tennessee. So when they have a humid day here in Arizona, I'd say it's raining cats and dogs.
Yeah,
so
right.
there's a real problem. But does the lab smell? No, not really. I have a dehumidifier in that area. So I can keep it down, but I get used to it a little bit, so other people come in and kind of go, oh, this must be where you keep the collection.
That's
so,
right.
And they're right.
Well, so how do you organize them? According to zoological taxonomy, or how?
Yeah. Okay. And in fact, the whole collection is that way. But I do keep dung in one side because of the nature of how you look at it and preserve it, and then the skeleton someplace else. But it's all taxonomic, so you could say, I'd like to look what koala poop looks like. Okay, well, we'll just go here, and here's koala poop, and you can compare it to wallaby and all these other marsupials. But if you had an unknown dung, and you said, Jim, what is this? I'd say, well, you go figure it out, Court. Here's the collection. You start working your way through. That's the best way to learn it. But it is all taxonomic.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Jim Mead, who is a professor of paleontology at East Tennessee State University near Johnson City, Tennessee. And I guess he's a kind of unofficially a professor of pooology because we're talking with him about his collection of excrement, both ancient and modern, and how that's used in science. So, Jim, what kinds of things do we learn from dung? Whether let's focus particularly on the ancient stuff, which I think is probably of more interest to most people listening.
Well, really, it all depends on what questions you have. Nerds, I didn't grow up thinking, oh, I want to be a scatologist. Mm. I grew up wanting to understand the past environment. And sometimes you come across an animal like, say, the mammoth or the shrub ox that's extinct. And you kind of go, why did that die out? And one option, of course, is people, earliest Americans, hunted them out. Okay, possible answer. Another one is, well, climate changed and its diet disappeared. And so it died of starvation or something like that. Well, how do we know what the diet is? Oh, well, let's look at its dung. So where do you find that dung? Well, you can find it in some frozen environment. So, okay, you got a lot of Canada and Alaska and Siberia to look at. And you can find it in super dry areas. Well, that's many areas, Mongolia, southern Siberia, Australia, and southwest USA, Mexico. And so you can go to these places to find this. Occasionally, you can find it in ideal wet spots like marshes and in some cases even in Florida in water scenarios that have not been disturbed. They found bundles of twigs that are obviously the gut content of a mastodon that they found right next to it. But usually, you're going to get it from dry cave. So if your question is, what did this animal eat and why is it dead, and that sort of thing, well, then now there's a lot of things that the dung will answer. If you want to say, well, how tall was this animal, well, the dung's not going to help you. So it really depends on your question. And my questions were, what was the diet of this animal or these animals? And then what plants were growing in that area? If all you eat is hamburgers and there's no more hamburger stands, you're either going to have to change your diet or go someplace else that has hamburger stands. So I was looking at diet and change of environment.
So you said that you couldn't tell how tall an animal is, but I would imagine that the size of the droppings, if you find it in undisturbed kind of situation, will tell you a lot about the size of the animal, no?
Well, that's true. I mean, when we went into this one cave that we've called Betcha Cave, which is Navajo for Big Poop Cave, for a good reason, we found over 300 cubic meters of dung, and most of that dung is from what we think is, we're pretty sure, is mammoth. Well, when we're digging, excavating this, things the size of a bowling ball, without exaggeration, are rolling out of the profile. So an animal that produces dung the size of a bowling ball, there's some correlation. This is not a rodent. It's not a snake. You know, it's obviously an animal with a bore that big.
Right.
So you're looking at a tall animal. But we're not going to get, I can't say, oh, it was not 11 feet, it was 12 feet. No, we can't get that from the dung.
Sure.
But we can get parasites. We can get pollen. We can get macrohistology, in other words, the big fragments that you see. We can get all kinds of information that tell us a little bit more information about the local environment and the animal that ate it.
So you can use both the microscope to look at seeds and you mentioned pollen and parasites.
Sure.
Can you actually find bacteria in a sample?
There's a number of people who have done some work to look at bacteria. In fact, for a while, some people were wondering, oh, was there a bacteria that kind of came in and wiped them out, sort of thing. And that hasn't gone too far. I don't think that they were necessarily wrong. I don't think our mechanism of looking at these things has progressed to the point. For instance, for a while, DNA, DNA answers everything, which does a lot of, but we couldn't get it out of dung, because we didn't have a mechanism to get micro samples. Well, now they do. And so now we can take, little turds and cut them up, and I can take a little turd and cut it in fragment, and the molecular guys can do their magic, and then I can do a chunk of that can be for pollen, and a chunk of that can be for radiocarbon date, and a chunk of that can be for microhistology. Well, now we know who did it, what was the environment, all kinds of stuff, and when it happened. Radiocarbon years ago.
So is there enough material from the animal itself, enough tissue or blood or whatever it might be that you can actually maybe do a DNA profile on that animal, 100,000 years later?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. The number of people are doing it. There are colleagues of mine at McMaster are working with that. People in Denmark are working with that. Tom Gilbert's student is working on that with the extinct mountain goat that I worked on in the Grand Canyon because we got so many dry cave dung deposits. So, yeah, they're getting all kinds of stuff. And what I try to do is bring together the dung, identify it the best way I can, archive it, and then tell all these molecular and all these biological folks, hey, I got some cool stuff. Put your magic to this fossil and maybe you'll find something new. I don't know that.
Is there any possibility in the future of being able to clone or approximate, sort of genetic engineering? I know that, science fiction movie, right? But
right.
I mean,
well,
is there
a possibility we're going to get out of debt? I hope so, but I don't know. Why not? Now, am I going to invest a lot of my money into it? No. Mm-hmm. But the people that are really top-notch on it, maybe they can. I'm totally open for this stuff.
Yeah.
My luck is if I did it, who knows what the animal would look like, like a toaster or something.
But I guess we could see the kind of similarities genetically between modern descendants of some animal, and you could kind of infer a lot from that and tweak the genes in the future. But anyway, we'll leave it at that. It's a possibility, but not something that we're at the doorstep of doing right now anyway, right?
Right. The main thing right now is I want to say, oh, cool, that cave, some animal went in there, did its morning constitution, and left, and I have a record of that.
Mm-hmm. How do other scientists use the samples in your poopery? Do they have to come in person, or they can email you and you'll send them a clipping, or how does that work?
Well, actually, all of the above. When I was curating for 22 national parks, most of them out west, then I was kind of archiving that for the park system. And so people would say, hey, I need such and such dung. Do you have it? And I'd say, sure, we have to go through park X, Y, and Z to get permission, and away you go.
Hmm.
But with the modern material that I have and some of the fossil material that I have here in Tennessee, I don't have all the material. I know what I left out there with the parks. But if somebody says, hey, I need sloth from South America, I go, okay, I'll give you a little chunk of what I do have.
Hmm.
And I also need mammoth from Arizona. Okay, now you're going to have to go to park X and Y.
Okay.
And that sort of thing. But if they want something, I have it. Presto. There's a place in Great Britain. They're starting to work more on stuff, and they're going to be using a lot of our modern material. So I'm just, needless to say, feeding them all kinds of poop, and they're loving it.
Fantastic. What kind of scientific tools do researchers use to analyze this stuff?
Well, again, it depends what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if we've used nuclear magnetic resonance to maybe get a chemical signature, and we thought, oh, this would be wonderful. Well, that became complex because there's a carryover signature of what you ate last night sort of thing.
Hmm.
So it got to be kind of cloudy in what were we getting a signature of. But, of course, and then the DNA folks, all the molecular jocks are doing all kinds of cool toys that they're inventing all the time to get more and more micro samples. Although we can work on, say, a whole dung bolus, there's also, could I just go into a cave that's dry, pick up some soil, and analyze kind of a bulk sample and get an idea of what animals went through there? I may not get a full record of who went through there, but if I found turkey vulture and camel and this and that, I know that they at least were in there at some point. Now, what they're doing there, I don't know.
What's the most interesting thing you've discovered so far in your research on dung? It must be something that really jumps out as being like a real eureka moment.
Well, let's face it, we all know it's totally bizarre.
Hmm.
And, of course, I don't wake up dreaming, think, oh, I'll find a new one today. But it is a tool, and it's really cool to go into a cave. We'll be doing this soon in early next year on the Colorado Plateau for a national park. We'll go into the cave, and there'll be dung all over the place. And to look at that and kind of go, wow, that was dropped by this extinct animal. I wonder what it ate. I wonder when it was. And there's how many radiocarbon years ago.
Hmm.
So that's really neat. And to see a mammoth bolus come not just rolling but tumbling out, that kind of gets your attention. And, of course, then you also start chuckling. Oh, look what it ate. This must have been a screamer. And then you start getting carried away. But, I mean, some things, animals are not chewing very well. My mom always said, chew 13 times before swallowing. And you look at this and go, you could have chewed 1,000 times. It wouldn't have made it any better.
The stuff they're eating is
kind of... Long strands
kinda, of grass. Kind of tough, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so what is... You know, I'm trying to picture this. You're talking about mammoth dung in a cave that may be 10 or 12,000 years old or whatever. And I don't think we're talking about a big steaming pile of, you know, cow patty on a large scale, but what does it look like? Is it all sort of desiccated, dried, chalky looking, or what?
Yeah. You walk in, and you, and unless it's really covered up, you walk in, and you, if it's close to the surface or at the surface, you feel like you're kind of walking a little bit on a like a sponge bog type thing. It kind of a little bit of a bounce to it, and you, if you put your foot down hard, it doesn't go tink, it goes ka-thunk. And that's telling you have depth to this thing, there's resonance, and so you know something's down there. The smell is there, the dirt, the cave sediment, if you will, instead of being probably gray, it has a brown to rusty brown color because of the organics. So after a while, you start putting all these little things that you start remembering, you kind of go, there's dung in this cave. And then you take it from there, what you're doing.
So you're talking about a place where there's a whole lot of dung. It's not just one little pile in one place where one animal did it one time, but do the animals tend to go into one, like, sort of outhouse cave and do their business all the time there then?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that one cave called Betcha Cave, Big Poop Cave, you know, one government supervisor back in D.C., I won't mention his name, unimportant, he said, well, Jim, what were the mammoths doing in that cave? Well, I know what they're doing in that cave. I got 300 cubic meters of it. I just don't know why they went in it.
Yeah.
And, of course, then you start thinking of Gary Larson cartoons, you know, two mammoths outside going, I'll be right back, I got to go to the cave, you know. But they went into the cave for a reason.
Yeah.
Dolphins go into Nungrongo Crater Cave in Africa to get salt off the wall. They go into total darkness. There's a good movie on that.
Mm.
And honestly, while going in there in total darkness, they're probably going to occasionally poop. Well, that's going to, if it's dry, it's going to preserve.
Mm.
So why did they go into this one cave? It's obviously not a small cave. The entrance is about 100 feet wide and 30 feet tall. So, I mean, you could go in there holding hands and dancing.
Mm.
And they went in there either to get out of the weather, who knows what, but they're doing their morning constitution in there.
I see.
In another cave, we got baby sloth bones. Well, maybe it was a slothing cave. I don't know what you would call it.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Dr. Jim Mead, who's a paleontologist at East Tennessee State University. And one of his primary focuses of his research is on his very large collection of ancient and modern dung from vertebrate animals that is a repository of great scientific interest to not only him and his group, but to people around the world who can find out a lot of things about ancient animals in particular from what's in their stools, right? But, Jim, let's turn to your broader research in paleontology beyond the poop collection here that we've been talking about so far. What's your general area of specialization, really?
Well, what I'm really doing active work on right now is the cranial morphology of lizard skulls, okay? So I'm looking at how their skulls are put together. So I'm looking at bones. And I'm looking at, I have a big project in Western Australia, working with a Western Australia museum, looking at how do you identify today's lizards that are out there. And then once I know how to identify the parts to a skull, not the full skull, but the parts to it, then can I go in the fossil record and say, oh, cool, this cave had this lizard, which doesn't occur there today.
Hmm.
But I find no matter what I'm working on, whether it's the lizards there or the lizards in Mexico that I'm working on, or the Grand Canyon, I still find, oh, I wonder what its dung looks like. So I guess that's ingrained in my mind. Oh, what was it eating? Can I get a record of that?
Well, we talked about, I think I mentioned the name of your lab there at ETSU, the Neogene Vertebrate Paleontology Laboratory. I guess I said that right. But it's I read that it's the largest collection of fossils in the U.S. of skulls and skeletons and dung of species from around the world. Is that true?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, we have a very large collection of certain animals. So if somebody says, where do I go to study a lot of lizard skulls or lizard taxa from around the world, we have one of the best collections of that. Now, clearly, there's other museums that really specialize in maybe one particular taxon or maybe that area. You know, let's say they're in Florida, they have a lot of Florida ones, but they don't have anything from, say, Australia or wherever. So we've collected for many, many years from around the world as much as we can. Pet trade, trading with museums, working for museums, that sort of thing.
How many total specimens are in your lab there?
Well, we got about 13,000 cataloged ones. And then we were just given a collection of material from a person, and so I think we're about probably 7,000 behind cataloging. So these are stuff collected back in the 40s and the 50s and 60s, and they didn't throw them away. They didn't really use them. They kept them, and they've decided to retire, and all of a sudden they go, oh, I know who studies this. So they're giving it to our lab. So our lab's expanding and growing quickly, which is fun and scary at the same time.
There you go. Well, you said that lizards is a main kind of core focus of your interest, and you know, obviously, I guess it seems to most people that lizards must be related to dinosaurs, but is there a direct connection? Are modern lizards in particular always descendants of some sort of dinosaur or other, or not?
Well, it sure seems like it, but no, they're not. I mean, it's sort of like saying, oh, I'm related to George Washington. Hmm. Well, yeah, I'm a human, but I'm not, you know, it's not real closely related. Lizards are in a group called lepidosaurs. Dinosaurs are in a totally different group, but the two together are in a group called diapsids. So there's similarities there.
Okay.
But, I mean, if I were to take a small, dinky, little, tiny dinosaur skull, put it out there all attached together, and then put a big lizard out that's the same size, and you look at it, you kind of go, oh, I see the difference. Yeah, it won't confuse them. But on TV and superficially, we go, oh, if I just let that lizard, you know, live 25 years, it will turn into a dinosaur. Absolutely not. It just doesn't work that way.
So your interest in lizards is not because you're a paleontologist and you're interested in dinosaurs and you're trying to see the connection. It's a separate, independent interest in lizards, right?
Yeah, I like, I've worked a lot with lizards. I like to look at where they were in the past. To do that, I have to understand their bones. And so to understand their bones, I need to have a collection. And we all know that an adult can look different than a baby. So I need a baby and a middle-aged and an adult of everything. And when I went to Australia, the Western Australia Museum said, could you identify the fossils? And I said, sure, where's your modern collection? Oh, we don't have one. Well, do you want me to build you one? Yes. Well, that was 12 years ago, and I'm still doing it. So it's that type of thing.
Well, Dr. Mead, it's been interesting talking with you about your dung collection there at East Tennessee State University and about paleontology in general. And I know that our listeners out there will start sending you Bigfoot stool samples and things like that. But
I'll get pictures for sure.
Well, I hope so. That may continue to make it interesting. But it does sound like, I think collections are generally considered kind of the dull side of zoology and biology. But it sounds like you have a lot of fun with your collection and with the media attention you get, latest and perhaps least on American Variety here. But I certainly thank
it's
you.
It's all a blast.
Yeah, well, that's fun, and you sound like you enjoy it, and you're learning a lot and teaching a lot, too, so that's a good thing. I do appreciate you being on with us on American Variety.
Good enough, Court. You take care of yourself.
You too, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.